Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Great to be back with you. Unfortunately, our summer is winding down. And usually after Labor Day, the political campaigns are in high gear. So in this first hour, we're going to concentrate on Vermont political campaigns and elections with political analyst Eric Davis and then Steve Terry. And then after that, we'll check in with Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos about election security. The FBI has warned states, particularly Colorado, of possible attempts to hack into the election process. We'll discuss with Secretary of State Condos if this is a problem in Vermont. And then after we check in with Bob Ney at Talk Media News, we'll open up the phone lines about your feelings about this upcoming election, particularly the national election. And also political figures you admire. Friday, we left many of you waiting on the phone lines because we ran out of time on the program when you wanted to express your opinions about these questions. So I wanted to make sure that we make time available so everyone gets a chance to call in and respond. And then this week, and we'll be doing more of it this week, it is going to be this weekend the 15th anniversary of 9/11 and the terrorist attacks in New York City, Washington, just outside Washington, D.C., and Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And coming up, I want to spend some time during the week talking about 9/11, why it's important to you, why it's important that we remember. So that's what's coming up today. Let's get started with Vermont politics. On the phone joining us this morning is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College, Eric Davis. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Mike.
The candidates for political office have filed their campaign finance reports now. What did we learn, starting with the governor, what did we learn with those campaign finance reports?
Well, these reports, Mike, were filed at the end of August, and they basically covered the period from the primary until the end of August. So that's sort of a bit of a lull in the campaign. You know, the excitement surrounding the primary was over. As you mentioned, the fall campaign really traditionally doesn't get going until right after Labor Day. So neither candidate, Bill Scott nor Sue Minter, was really doing much in terms of fundraising. But I would say what I took away from them, from some of the other reports filed, too, is that this election really isn't going to be decided by how much money these candidates can raise. Both the Scott campaign and the Minter campaign are going to have plenty of money to pay for advertising, both traditional broadcast advertising on TV and radio, and as well as advertising and communications on social media. They're both going to have plenty of money for polling, for field organization around the state, get out the vote drives, and so forth. So I would think when all is said and done, probably both the Scott and the Minter campaigns will raise a little over $1 million, and then perhaps an amount that's equal to, if not somewhat larger than that, will be spent on their behalf by the National Political Committees, the Republican Governors Association and the Democratic Governors Association, as well as outside super PACs that will get into this race.
The RGA has already started spending heavily in this state, the RGA being the Republican Governors Association, whereas the Democratic Governors Association hasn't yet began to spend. Is there anything to read in that?
I'm sure the DGA will get involved soon. I did look at some national material on governor elections this fall, Mike, and I found it very interesting. First of all, there are only 12 states that will be electing governors this year. Most of the states now elect their governor for a four-year term in the off-year cycle. And then of the 12 elections for governor this year, there's none of them in the very biggest states, New York, California, Texas, Florida, Ohio, all those states where there's really a lot of money spent on gubernatorial races, none of them have an election. So the 12 governor seats up for election this fall, there's only six of them that are considered competitive, and Vermont is one of them. So actually, I think both the RGA and the DGA are going to spend quite a lot of money in Vermont. It's an open seat race that's considered competitive, and there aren't the competing demands on these committees from the large states that they traditionally get heavily involved in.
Eric, I'm curious now that we're talking about the governor's race, how did the candidates come out of the primaries? In good shape? Any political damage to any of these candidates?
No, I think both Phil Scott and Sue Minter came out of the campaign in good shape. I mean, both of them, I think, within their respective primaries, ran campaigns that would be considered positive. They focused on their own backgrounds and accomplishments and on the issues. Well, there were some other candidates that went negative to a greater or lesser degree. Those two did not. I do think that some of the charges made by other candidates against Minter and Scott will probably be resurrected by the other party in the fall campaign. I would not be surprised, for example, to see, if not the Minter campaign, the Vermont Democratic Party certainly picking up on some of Bruce Lisman's themes about Scott having a conflict of interest by owning a business which contracts with the state. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the Vermont Republican Party pick up on some of the themes used by Peter Galbraith, in particular in the Democratic campaign, that Minter is too close to industrial wind developers.
One of the things, let's turn to Lieutenant Governor and AG, because those are seem to be the contested statewide office. I know there's a contest in Auditor of Accounts, but let's concentrate on Lieutenant Governor and AG. How did their campaign finance reports sort of, what did it show us?
Yeah, I think in the case of Lieutenant Governor, Randy Brock is in very good shape because he had no primary opponent. So he has a couple $100,000 in the bank already. Dave Zuckerman spent most of what he raised to win the primary, but he also showed fundraising prowess during the primary campaign. So again, I'm sure that both Brock and Zuckerman will have enough money. Governor candidates typically spend a little bit over $1 million. I think for lieutenant governor, we're probably looking at something more in the range of somewhere between $300,000-$400,000, I think is enough to run a competitive campaign for that office. And it seems that both Zuckerman and Brock will certainly be able to do that. So again, this is a race where I don't think money is going to determine the outcome.
One of the things we just mentioned that struck me was the fact that, you know, 200 to 400K is the expected amount that you would have to raise to win the lieutenant governor's race. It wasn't that long ago when that was the number for the governor's race.
That's right. Back in 02, for example, when we had an open governor's race after Howard Dean stepped down, around $500,000 was enough to run a competitive race for governor, and you're probably looking at about $200,000 for lieutenant governor, attorney general, some other down ballot office that was open. And I would say in the last 10 to 15 years, those numbers have about doubled.
Yeah, it is interesting that today it's not only did we have a costly primary, but it is going to be a costly general election. Turning to AG, TJ Donovan and Deb Bucknam, anything to learn from their campaign?
Yeah, in this race, I think it is a different situation than governor and lieutenant governor. TJ Donovan has a very healthy campaign balance. He's well known, having run for the office in the primary against Bill Sorrell 4 years ago. He's raised a lot of money. He's not going to have any difficulty raising what he needs to for a competitive campaign. Deb Bucknam, an attorney from St. Johnsbury, has never run for office before. She certainly is a qualified candidate for the position. She's practiced law in Vermont for a long time and in different types of courts. But she has nowhere near the name recognition as T.J. Donovan. And I think her other difficulty is, it seems to me, Mike, that the real focus of the Vermont Republicans this fall is on A, electing Phil Scott governor, B, electing Randy Brock lieutenant governor, and C, picking up some more seats in the legislature, particularly in the House. And those are the big priorities for the Republicans this year. And while I'm sure Bucknam will run a credible campaign, I think she faces a very difficult situation running against the experienced and well-known T.J. Donovan.
debate this year, both in the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race, have become an issue because in the governor's race, Scott's team insists that Bill Lee be invited. And in this U.S. Senate race, Senator Leahy insists of on only three debates, none of them on commercial television networks. Let's start with the governor's race first. Is that a good move to insist that three candidates be on the stage?
I don't think so. I mean, with all due respect to Bill Lee, and, you know, he had accomplishments as a pitcher for the Red Sox, but we'll leave those aside for the moment. He's not going to be elected governor of Vermont. And I think the best situation for the voters of Vermont is to hear as much as possible from Phil Scott and Sue Minter without other people on the stage. There's some media organizations that traditionally have run open to all forums, Vermont Public Broadcasting, Vermont Public TV in particular. But I think the voters on balance benefit more when there are more debates between just the major party candidates who have a realistic possibility of winning the office.
Senator Leahy is insisting on only three debates, none of those debates on a commercial TV network, meaning Channel 3, Channel 5, or Channel 22, and limiting sort of the exposure of those debates. Is that a good strategy for him?
Well, it's the classic incumbent strategy of debating as little as you can get away with. And it's a strategy that's used by incumbents of both parties. I think considering Senator Leahy's seniority, his approval ratings, the amount of money he had, I think he's going a bit overboard on this. And again, for the benefit of the voters, even though Leahy is obviously a strong favorite in this race, I think they deserve to have a situation on one of the commercial networks where Leahy and Scott Milner are questioned and get to talk about issues for an hour or 90 minutes. So I think the senator is being too restrictive in terms of the conditions under which he'll debate.
Leahy seems to have the safest seat in America by some accords. Any chance that Milner can pull an upset?
No, I don't think he's going to pull an upset. What I'm interested in, though, in this race, Mike, is Leahy got 71% of the vote in 12 years ago, which was 2004. It was a presidential year. In 2010, when he was reelected in an off year, he still won substantially, but his vote share dropped a little bit, 64%. So I'm interested to see whether he can get back up closer to 70% this year in a presidential year, or whether, you know, the sort of fatigue with him that I think Scott Milner is trying to capitalize on might lead to a vote share for him that's closer to 60% this year. So for me, the question is not who's going to win the race, but how high is Senator Leahy's percentage going to be, and is it going to be as high as it was the last time he ran in a presidential year?
Will Shumlin make any difference in this upcoming election?
I think if Shumlin actively campaigns for Sue Minter, it probably hurts her. So I think politically the best thing for Shumlin would be to keep as quiet as possible and focus on being governor up until his term ends.
And what can we expect from the gubernatorial candidates in the upcoming weeks?
Well, I mean, there'll be debates which will be beginning later this month. I think at this point, they're going to start advertising more. You know, we're getting into the fall when days are a bit shorter. TV viewership is up a bit. I think they're particularly, my sense, Mike, is in the next few weeks, working on building field organizations, getting staffed up around the state, building field offices, collecting data, starting to contact voters. And then once we get into the first week of October, then they're going to start gearing up the early voting push. In Vermont, you can cast an absentee or early ballot up as many as 45 days before the election. So that's actually sometime during the last week of September. So in early October, I think what the candidates are going to try and do is start working on identifying core supporters and encouraging them, if at all possible, to vote early and get those votes locked up so that they can spend their time later in October and early November working more on the people who've yet to make up their minds.
Eric Davis, as always, thank you very much for the information that you provide us.
My pleasure, Mike.
Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College. Coming up, Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst. We'll check in with him on his take on what to expect in the upcoming election and also the political campaign finance reports. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. As I said before, after Labor Day, the political campaigns are usually in high gear or getting into high gear. So this first hour, we're concentrating on Vermont political campaigns and elections. We just spoke with Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science, about his take on what the various campaigns are doing. And up now on the phone is Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst. And we'll be speaking pretty much the same topics with Steve to get his take on it. Good morning, Steve.
Morning, Mike. How are you?
Great, thank you. The candidates for political office have filed their campaign finance reports that covers to the end of August. Anything that we learned in those reports, starting with governor?
Well, what I learned was this is, from a money perspective, Mike, going to be a very, very competitive race. And it demonstrates to me that each of these candidates will have the financial resources that is needed. Now, the election is 62 days away. There's obviously going to be a tremendous amount of fundraising in that time period, but both of these candidates spent almost the same in the primary, although Sue a little more, but that will probably not be a problem. One of the things, Mike, that did impress me, looking at the expenditure side of the report, was that Sue Mintner is using Hart Research, which is a well-known polling firm that has done a lot of work over the years for Democratic candidates, including Peter Shumlin. And Phil Scott is using Public Opinion Strategies, which you will probably remember, Mike, as the firm that did Jim Douglas's polling in his campaigns. So these polling firms, and they also, by the way, do work for Vermont businesses and other organizations, had a deep reservoir of knowledge about Vermont, its voters, and how it reacts to issues. I guess I found that those two little nuggets to be interesting to me, at least.
Steve, did any of these candidates, both Sue Mintner and Phil Scott, come out of their respective primaries damaged, or did they come out pretty good shape?
I thought overall they did. They both ran positive campaigns. I think Sue demonstrated that obviously she was a little more of a cautious candidate on some issues. And certainly, Phil Scott, it seemed at times, was kind of laying back and not strongly in engaging. And as you and I know, 10 days out before the primary on the Republican side, it was an even race. But it didn't end up that way. So I think perhaps the lesson for Phil Scott is he has to be run a much more energetic campaign than he did in the primary. Sue Mintner is probably got to demonstrate to Vermont's Democrats, especially those who have been so-called business Democrats, that she has what it takes to deal with the Vermont economic issues, But more importantly, I'm starting to hear who will be the best candidate to deal with a still a very, very heavily Democratic legislature. And as the weeks go ahead, at least I will be looking to see how Sue Minter deals with that issue. On the Phil Scott side, I will be looking at how he will talk about perhaps other issues than just only the economic issue, although I do think both their polling demonstrates that is issue number one in Vermont.
Sizing up the lieutenant governor's race between David Zuckerman and Randy Brock, what's your take on that?
I think that race demonstrated that Zuckerman, through his use of ads, now Randy didn't have to run ads, he was not opposed, but he did extraordinarily well. The question that I have is back to what offers Vermont the most balance? And I am starting to hear that perhaps Vermonters will split their tickets even more this year and vote for Phil Scott and Randy Brock in a very strong legislature. I think Dave Zuckerman has got to demonstrate how he would deal with the economic issues, and I think Randy Brock has to demonstrate how he's much more, shall we say, a man of the people. That certainly is the hallmark of his running mate, Phil Scott.
T.J. Donovan, Deb Bucknam running for AG. Is it T.J. Donovan's to lose?
Oh, my gosh, yes. He's got such a strong fundraising advantage, and he has been he's been raising money for more than a year. The question that I have in that race, Mike, is how will T.J. Donovan, if he's elected as expected, deal with the EB-5 controversies? Because, as we know, Bill Sorrell is not seeking re-election, but that is an extremely hot issue that is in that office to be dealt with. And I guess I haven't heard how T.J., who is close to Leahy, close to Shumlin, would be dealing with that matter.
And the issue is obviously the emails. They're kind of been sequestered under Attorney General Bill Sorrell. Would T.J. continue that sequestration, I guess, is the word.
Right. I think that remains to be seen.
Debates. It's a weird year this year. A governor in the governor's race, Phil Scott is insisting that Bill Lee be invited to any debate that he attends. Is that a good strategy for him?
Well, I frankly don't think it is. It'll be great. It would be great, maybe entertainment value. But this is serious business, electing a governor. And these two candidates, Phil Scott and Sue Minter, are obviously, one of them will be elected. And we just need as much time as we can, Vermonters, that is, to understand their views on various issues. Remember, we don't very often have open races for governor. So there is a premium this year on finding out, understanding, listening to the candidates, more importantly, as much as watch them interact with each other so we can judge what kind of temperament they have and how they view issues in this state.
Senator Leahy has insisted on only three debates. That's what incumbents try to do, is limit their number of debates. Is that a good strategy for
him? Well, I don't think the Rose Garden strategy helps. And my gosh, Senator Leahy has, been elected many times. He doesn't have anything to really worry about. And frankly, it would be important for Vermonters to hear how he views what's going to happen to the U.S. Supreme Court nominee and other privacy issues. And frankly, there are people interested in what he might do to help the dairy economy in Vermont, which right now is in pretty tough shape.
Will Shumlin have any influence in this upcoming election? Or?
Well, I think the disclosure reports demonstrated that the Shumlin is that Governor Shumlin is all in, and from a financial perspective, with the Sue Mintner campaign, as is his brother, and the Shumlin staff are clearly trying to help Sue Mintner. Will the governor himself campaign for her? I think he'll probably remain being governor quietly and build his new home in Westminster West.
Steve Terry, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Mike.
Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst, weighing in on his opinions on the upcoming election. Coming up, Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos. Are Vermont elections secure from hackers? We'll ask that question to Secretary of State Condos in a minute. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It is my great pleasure to welcome to our WDEV studios Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Mike. It's great to be here.
The FBI has warned states like Illinois and Arizona. I originally had said Colorado, but I must be smoking something. States like Illinois and Arizona to be watchful for hackers, particularly Russian hackers. Should we be concerned at that? Those nationwide, and then let's turn to Vermont.
Well, I think nationwide, we probably always should be diligent and vigilant and really pay attention. But I think it's also important. I actually participated in the phone call with Secretary Johnson from Homeland Security and other secretaries. And it was really, I guess what concerned me most was they really didn't know how our systems work. And they were assuming that they're all interconnected and online and all that. And we were trying to explain to them that in approximately 40 states, we use optical scanners. And those optical scanners are not connected either by hardwire or Wi-Fi. They're separate, standalone units. And most of those states, I think in all of those states, there is a paper ballot at the end of the day. And this includes Vermont. So we have something as an audit trail. Here in Vermont, we do an audit after every general election. Within 30 days, we hold an audit, and last time we did six towns. We don't notify them until after the election which towns are going to be audited, and we do six towns, all races, and we do this audit with completely different equipment. To make sure that our vote tallies are accurate, that they haven't been manhandled in any way. So I guess going back to the whole issue, I think I don't see a concern so much with the units themselves. There's probably more of a concern, with the voter databases, which, by the way, most of our public databases to begin with, because it is a public record, and we only show certain information, name and address, but we don't show Social Security number, we don't show date of birth, we don't show driver's license number. So that's the stuff that I think most of the time the hackers are probably trying to grab. And we actually, in Vermont, 3 years ago, we were getting ready for I was actually at a conference, and the current governor of Oregon, Kate Brown, was Secretary of State at the time, and she had come to the conference and said that her corporate registration files had been hacked. So I came back from that, and I asked my staff, how are we prepared for a hack if something were to happen? And they assured me that we had done a lot, that we had proper firewalls in place. But they said, you know, we always could use some help. So we went out and had a risk assessment done of all of our systems, including the elections, which didn't actually happen until after the new system was put in place last fall. But we had a risk assessment put in place, and with that knowledge, we made some improvements to even make us more unhackable.
Let's just go back to Arizona for a moment, because I think there's a distinction here. In Arizona, do they do their elections electronically that can be hacked into, or do you know that?
I don't know for sure. There are 10 states that actually use what we call DREs, which are electronic touchscreen, and there is no ballot at the end of that process. So you really don't. In fact, it amazes me. How do you run a recount if you have a recount situation? I don't know how they would do that. But no, I don't know. There are only about 10 states that actually use that equipment. And most of them, I understand, are trying to look at getting going back to scanners.
And in Vermont, the reason why we can be assured of protection is that we do use the scanners. We use a paper ballot. We can sort of recreate the entire election if we have to.
If we had to. And keep in mind, we had to do a complete statewide recount for the governor's race as short a time ago as 2010.
We're speaking with Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos, and we're talking about election security. If you want to join our conversation or if you have a comment or an opinion, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. How can Vermonters be assured that the election process continues to be safe and secure?
So we continue to do the due diligence from our standpoint. And Mike, this is something that I don't know from your days at the administration, but when I came back from that meeting with Oregon Secretary of State Kate Brown, I called up DII and I said, hey, we want to do a risk assessment. Can you help us out? No. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, you're the first agency that's actually asked us for that. And I was like, what? So we went out and did our own RFP. We did a complete agency-wide. We're, to my understanding, we're the first agency to do an agency-wide risk assessment. We also did it for security as well, physical security, as well as cyber. And we had a report, and we used that report to really tie things down and make ourselves better. We also have an ongoing system that we check all the time. Now, in this report, this flyer that came out from the FBI to all the secretaries, they actually listed a bunch of IP addresses, of problem IP addresses. So we actually ran that through our logs to see if there had been any attempts to our system. There weren't. We constantly monitor it. We also sent it over to DII so that they could check their logs as well.
When the secretary was speaking with you, was the fear that the election could be rigged by a hacker, or was the fear that they could steal information about the voter?
They didn't really make that clear. I think what we garnered from that conversation was there were two things that were driving it, the whole discussion. One was the DNC hack earlier this year. The second was a certain presidential candidate's comments about a rigged election. So in both of those cases, I think it just raised enough of a level that they were concerned about it. They wanted to have further conversations.
Turning to this past primary, because we just finished an election, what did we learn about this primary, voter turnout, anything else that we learned from this primary?
Well, I think the biggest thing we learned about turnout was if you have competitive races, you're going to have turnout. And considering everybody was naysaying the whole idea that having it in early August was going to be bad, that we were going to have, you know, probably the lowest turnout on record, we ended up having the highest turnout on record that we know of.
And what was that, Jim? Do you remember?
It was about 120,000 people that actually came out and voted. Okay. And the previous high before that was 117, and that was in 2010. The previous before that was 105,000, and that was in 2000, and that was the Ruth Dwyer, Bill Muebe race that actually drove that. Mm-hmm. So I think what we learned, first of all, we had two competitive races for governor on both sides, and we also had a very competitive race for lieutenant governor on the Democratic side. So those two races right there, those situations, I think, created the buzz. And I think there was also a lot of the candidates have really gotten sophisticated about trying to get people out to vote. And there's no question that that's playing into this.
We had 120,000 come out for the primary election in August. What's your expectation for the November election?
Typically, in a presidential year, we go between 65 and 72% of the voter checklist. And in a non-presidential year, it's usually around 55%. So it drops off about 10 to 15 points in the non-presidential. So this year, I think we'll probably end up somewhere around 65 to 72%. And that we also have what we haven't had very often, as you know, you spoke about earlier, a very competitive governor's race and lieutenant governor's race. So all of that is going to play into this.
And plus, it's a presidential year. So in terms of voters, we had 120,000 in the primary. What are we looking for in the general election?
Let's see. We're going to probably end up at about 460,000 registered voters by the time November 8th rolls around. So if you figure 70% of that, it's going to be about 275,000 to 300,000 people.
What is one of the things that we learned in the primary, and probably it will go into the general election, is that if you want to run for at least the two highest offices in Vermont, which is governor and lieutenant governor, it's going to be a very expensive election for you.
It has certainly got that makings. We had what I guess is the highest spending for a primary ever. You know, if you total it all up, it was probably around $5 million that were spent.
And that's just the candidates, right?
That's
not the outside groups.
That's correct. So I mean, you had two candidates on the Democratic side for $2 million. You had one candidate on the other side for $1 million. The other was $2 million. There's $5 million right there, just mm-hmm. those five candidates. That's not even talking about the lieutenant governor's race. I think one of your other employers is probably very happy these days.
Turning to the upcoming election, what are some of the important dates for Vermonters to remember?
Well, that's great because it's coming right up. September 23rd is early vote starts, early absentee, and that's when we actually have to. We're mandated by the federal government to get ballots out to overseas and military voters. We have a new system that's in place. It's done a great job. We actually had 100% compliance for the primary, so we were really pleased with that. So it starts September 23rd, and the next date that we're really concerned about is going to be November 2nd, which is Wednesday, November 2nd. That's the Wednesday before Election Day, and that is the deadline at 5 o'clock that day for voter registration. And then, of course, the final day is actually Monday the 7th at 5 o'clock will be close of business on 5 o'clock on Wednesday the 7th for coming in to vote early. And then, of course, November 8th is the big day.
Now, early absentee ballots, are those available to anyone?
Yes.
Okay.
No excuse. Anyone can – you can go into your town clerk's office. You can request it online. You can call them up and ask for it. You can ask for it in any number of ways. You can even ask for it through our website. Every registered voter in the state of Vermont has what we call a voter page. It's a specific page just to each registered voter, has their information. You can change your address if it has changed. You can find your clerk's contact information. You can find out where your polling place is. If you want a Google map of how to find it, you can do that. You can request your absentee ballot through this as well. You can also see sample ballots if you want to see what are the races in your area.
One of the things, the dynamic that's changing in voting seems to be that more and more people are voting absentee, and the campaigns are adjusting to that as well. Is that pose a different set of issues for you?
Well, no, except that we do get a lot of questions afterwards where someone will call up and say, hey, I voted early, but I've changed my mind. It's too late. Yeah. So we always caution people, be sure when you vote early that you're voting for the person you want. But we haven't seen a real run-up. In some states, it's up as high as 50% is being done as early vote. We got up to about 30% a few years ago, and it's kind of stayed in that 25 to 30% range. We're making it easier for people if they want to. I mean, if you live in Oregon, Washington, or Colorado, you actually do vote by mail. They will send a ballot to every registered voter on their checklist, and you have to get it back by a certain date.
Let me just change subjects for just a moment, and then I'll come back to what we started out with, which is security. Whatever happened to the Ethics Commission?
It died an early death. Actually, I should say a late death. It never really got enough traction. The Senate actually passed what I guess at best call a watered-down version. It was a good step forward, but it wasn't what I had asked for. I'm going to push for it again this year. I think it is important. I think it should include the administration, the executive branch, and it should include the legislature in some format. And I recognize fully that there's constitutional issues, but I think we can overcome those, especially if it's the legislature making those changes. And I do think it should involve municipal governments as well. That's where we probably see and receive the most calls.
And what are the prospects? I mean, you kind of don't know, because the legislature will be changing over. You'll have a new speaker. You'll have a new lieutenant governor. You'll have a new Senate pro tem. You will have a new everything in the legislature.
It's going to be an exciting year come January.
You have a new governor. Speaking of new governors, what will happen to boards and commissions? Governors fill those positions. You oversee many of those boards and commissions. What typically happens when you have a turnover in governors?
Well, really, it doesn't affect the makeup of the board at the current status. What they will do is continue to move forward. The committees and commissions will continue to vote. Will operate. They do not just disappear and have a new commission created. What happens is, as of that date, the governor, who makes most of these appointments, will now be the one in charge of making appointments and will receive applications from people who want to participate in that format. So, you know, even though I oversee a bunch of boards at the Office of Professional Regulation, they're appointed by the governor. So
let's go to the phone line and let's quickly get a call in. Bill from South Burlington, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
That's good news.
I had a question about the voter page and the security about that. What prevents someone besides me from not changing my address or going into my voter page? What sort of security and procedures or protocols are in place around the voter pages?
Sure, that's a great question. So in order to get to the voter page, you have to provide your first name, last name, your driver's license number, your date of birth, and in some cases you may have to, if you don't have a driver's license, Vermont driver's license, you may have to because you just moved here or something, you may have to provide last four digits of your Social Security, which you would have placed on your original form when you registered. So those are the basic pieces of information. And the other thing is that if there's a change in the address or whatever, the system we have creates – it actually sends the application to the town clerk, the appropriate town clerk. It reads the address, the street address, and the zip code, and then sends it to the town clerk. And the town clerk is the one that has to approve it to put it on the checklist or make a change. So there's a process involved. But we are very careful with this, and we think this is fairly unique. We're one of the first states to have this, but we think it's a really good thing for people to be able to access their government.
What keeps you up at night about security?
You know, it does bother me to think that we could get hacked, and that's why I think what you'll find here in Vermont and elsewhere in the country is that the secretaries of state are really paying attention. They're doing their due diligence. They're being vigilant about it, and they're continuing to work hard.
Where can we find out more if we want to learn more about where to register, what to do, how to vote? Where can we go?
You can go to our website, www.sec.state.vt.us, and when you get there, go to the elections page. You can find out information about registering. You can actually register online as well, so it works out pretty well.
Thank you very much, Jim Kondos. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That is Vermont Secretary of State Jim Kondos, and we were talking about, are Vermont elections secure from hackers? Coming up, we'll speak with our friend Bob Ney at Talk Media News, and then we're going to have some open mic, and I want to sort of finish up on some of the things that we did on Friday when many of you were unfortunately left waiting on the line, trying to get into the program. I apologize. We had a lot of phone calls on Friday, and I want to give the opportunity. I'll reboot the discussion, give the opportunity for you to give a call in. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. Can you believe it? 85 years at WDEV News Radio. We're not celebrating the past. We're celebrating the future. Going strong as always. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We now turn our attention to national issues, in particular political issues. And on the line with us this morning is one of our faves, Bob Ney. Bob, good morning.
Oh, you got my jogging song on. There you go. You know that.
Hey, let's start with Congress. They're returning today. Can we expect anything to get done in Congress before the election?
Well, putting on my old congressional hat, they are returning from the in-district work period, better known to regular earthlings as vacation, and they are coming back to Congress. They're going to go after the head of the Republicans, the head of the IRS, which, you know, is not going to hurt him, I don't think any. They're going to try to get him out. Supreme Court, they won't budge on that, the Senate. The big deal, what's going to happen, Mike, is going to be the agreement, notwithstanding they're going to yell at each other, but some kind of temporary agreement for funding the government, because, look, Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker, and Nancy Pelosi, just taking the House for a second, the Democratic leader, neither one. They're going to blame each other, but neither one wants this government to shut down in this nightmare of an election.
Harry Reid says we should not do a short-term fix. We should do a long-term fix. Are they going to do a long-term fix?
I'm sorry. Harry Reid's got a lot of nerve. He never did anything long-term, just as bad as Mitch McConnell, to be fair about this thing. Yeah, he's got to be kidding. Sure, he's going to. See, they're going to say these things. Then they're going to strain themselves and the gentleman and my friend and my enemy on the floor, and then they're going to do a happy kumbaya wink and blow a kiss at each other and do something. That's the bottom line. Yeah, Harry will say that.
Obama canceled a meeting with the president of the Philippines after that president, who is very colorful, called Obama a name. Was that the right thing to do?
Well, you know, yeah, I think it is, but Obama's got contradictions all over the place on this trip. You know, it was horrible what the president of the Philippines said, and I don't blame our president for canceling it, although I just was told a minute ago it might be back on. I doubt it, but I was told that. But the other thing is the president said, well, the football player, you know, he's got a right to express his free speech. Well, then all of a sudden the president of the Philippines, as ignorant as he was, doesn't have the right to express his free speech. He cancels the speech, is made to get off the back of the plane by the Chinese. He just needs to call kind of quits on this trip and just come back. This one didn't honestly go too good. And then the TPP trade issue came up again where the president said, I'd love to have this. It's hurting us, yet Hillary doesn't want it, or Trump, you know, but because of the campaign. So I don't know. Why should the president, you know, the president of the Philippines referred to the president's mother as a prostitute. And, you know, why meet with him? I mean, mm-hmm. The president's a human being. So.
China dissed the president on the tarmac, beginning right at the beginning of the G20 summit. Did Obama do the right thing in ignoring the Chinese?
No, he didn't. And I'll tell you why. I have met personally with Jiang Zemin, the previous you know, dictator, I should say, of China. Met with him in Beijing with a group of people. They only understand one thing, the government of China. If you push at them, that's all they understand. If you do anything else and you don't push them, they'll walk all over you twice and laugh about it. Every world leader got those, you know, steps brought up to the plane. Not only do they not bring steps with the red carpet, which would be fine, honestly, but they make him go out of the back of the plane. Now, do you take the Trump approach out of turn the plane around and go home? No, there's a whole conference there. But I think when they were yelling at Susan Rice, you know, who's ambassador of the United Nations for us, and the Secret Service had to step in, and the Chinese are saying, this is our country, we'll do what we want. They didn't want the press near the wing. That's where President Obama can come off and say, you know, I understand where they're coming from. They're a communist regime that doesn't believe in free press. Mm-hmm. Why not? That way he pushes back a bit, but he doesn't turn the plane around and go home. But I think just dismissing it's, I don't know why he didn't say something.
Speaking about regimes that don't agree with the free press, North Korea fired a missile over the weekend. That missile was sort of coordinated to coincide with the start of the G20. It sent a very ominous sort of signal to many allies out there, particularly Japan and South Korea. What should we take from this missile firing?
This is always what they do. They rattle their sword. Look, this is a dictator who starves his people to death, and they praise him. I mean, he's crazy. I mean, he's just completely out of his mind, and his father was too. And they're not going to stop. I mean, they're always going to do this type of thing until they're removed, one after the other, if necessary. But, you know, that's another whole story and argument to it. But we're just going to have to live with these people the way that the dictator is over there. Scary thing is a nuclear weapon. I mean, we worry about Iran. I would be 10 times worried about North Korea.
I mean, one of the things that they're firing are medium-range missiles, but they're working on long-range missiles as well, and that should be a major concern for us, missiles that can hit the United States.
Well, yeah, look, if they get close to that, and this is going to sound so ugly, and so I pre-apologize, somebody, if it's us or whoever, is going to have to take him out with a pinpoint missile. If they make another lunatic head of their government, they're going to have to take him out, too. They're going to have to just keep going. It's going to be, we're going to get nuked, or we're going to stop them. I mean, again, Iran, you've got Israel that can nuke them 500 times over. Iran knows that. This guy, it's a different world.
One of the things that you don't do...
Don't make me president. Okay?
No, one of the things that you don't do in North Korea is fall asleep. His deputy education commissioner fell asleep at a meeting, and guess what happened to him?
Did they kill him?
He was executed. So,
wow. Well, you know how many members of Congress would be gone during session? We cleaned the whole place out.
Over the weekend, Trump went to a black church. Smart move?
I think so. Look, I know he's just getting criticized over and over, and he didn't know what the Shaw meant and things, you know, that they gave him. It's okay. I think it was a smart move for him. Look, maybe late in the process, but at least he's doing something. And plus, I know there's not a large percentage of African Americans supporting him, but there are some African Americans that do support him. So I don't think it hurts, you know, any more than, you know, Hillary Clinton eventually, though, after 270 days, has got the press on the plane with her. You know, I mean, that's not hurting her. Where's she been for 270 days? And where's Trump been all this time? But, you know, I think it's okay what he did. It stirred something in the Clintons where they're coming back hitting him as a racist because they're afraid of, this is such a tight election, they're afraid of 1% more of any minority vote going to him.
Is this helping a red herring thrown out there by the Trump campaign and others?
What's that?
This health of Hillary Clinton. Is this a red herring?
Oh, you know, let me be real fair about this. Ellen and I talked privately this morning about it. I want to be really, really fair. I was on the campaign trail for 24 years. I did what she did, the coughing fit, you know, that she had in Cleveland. Maybe not as severe as she had, but I've done it. And any other time, you know, it's something went down the wrong way, and with the whole questions raised about her and how she kind of, you know, walks and things like that, that's been raised by the press privately and publicly, wasn't good timing. The you know, she does this again with a coughing fit. It's not good timing. But Donald Trump needs to not comment on it. Let people decide, you know. So I'm not trying to be harsh about the fact she coughed, but it was so bad. It raises questions right now. It's just like one more email on the Clinton Foundation. Whether they did anything bad or illegal or not is irrelevant. It's just one more thing.
You know, Bob, I saw a headline over the weekend that sort of got me thinking, and it was about Trump using Nate Silver's analysis of Ohio. It said that Trump misapplied the analysis. And I have to admit, and I'm now a big Trump fan, but I have to admit, I said, so what? Is this really important? And it sort of raised the question, is the press overzealous in reporting miscues with Trump?
Absolutely. Look, I watched the press just turn. If Donald Trump's campaign manager, Kelly Ann Conway, if her husband took his shirt off and laid in a bed with their child and sent it out, she would have to resign. I mean, end of the story, right? She would have to. Hillary Clinton, Huma didn't have to resign. Now, I raise that because amidst all of this, not that it didn't get some bad attention, and it, you know, it should have, but at the same time, those two-week period there, the press went so overboard on Trump. You know, he handed out Play-Doh. Well, kids don't know about floods. They need stuff, too. I mean, they just went crazy on him. To the point, Mike, I'm sitting there myself going, wow, okay, that's a little too far, even though Trump deserves some things. And then I do what I do all the time. I went to get my hair cut, and I asked the girl cutting my hair, who hates all politicians, and she turned around and said, you know what, I think, I don't know this Trump guy, but she said, I think that somebody, he must be maybe okay because they're really going after him. So, yeah, I think that they went a little too far.
Hillary Clinton has had a horrible 2 weeks. Has she reached her bottom?
Now, this is a fascinating question you've asked because I don't think so, no. And I don't think he has either. These two deserve each other in the sense of, you know, one goes down and you think, wow, and then the other goes down and does something. I don't think she has. I mean, she's pretty close to it, but I think this entire, and I believe this, and I said it on your show, it's going to be so razor thin by the time these two are done. I don't think she's going to rise way back up, and he's not. I think it's going to continue to flatline for both of them to where it boils down to, you know, you could have a 500 votes decides this election again. Now, she's ahead in Electoral College, though.
Mm-hmm.
She's ahead there.
And, I mean, do you see this as a race to the bottom? It seems like that's the case here.
Yes. I do. I don't think he's done, and I don't think she's done. This October the 17th, the State Department, and why on earth they did this, I think it's wrong. They announced her schedule's not going to be released. We can't get it together till December. Then what did they announce 4 days ago? Yeah, we're going to release it in October.
Hmm.
What? The FBI providing the notes, which she was cleared of everything, and whether anybody likes that or not, you don't provide the notes. They're providing the notes, and there's more. And then the emails, the million pieces that's being put back together on the Clinton Foundation. So I think she just needs to brace herself, and you know, she's going to have to get around this. And then they've got three debates coming up.
What do you expect in those debates, Bob? I'm fascinated by what to expect in those debates.
I can't, you know, I'm going to be in India for the first debate, and I will be watching it. I don't care if it's 2 a.m. in India, I'll be watching the thing. Because if he can come out and not, you know, implode himself on national TV, if he can just hold his own, this becomes a real horse race for the second debate. I don't think he's going to go completely, you know, way out there, but he's going to attack her, and he has to attack her. And she can attack him, but you know what? He's been attacked and will continue to be attacked. That debate, she has to show why people have to believe her, you know, of where she's going to be on positions. It's not enough that Donald Trump is a narcissistic guy that could put his finger on the nuclear trigger. That's not enough in this election. This is fascinating.
You know, there seems to be among the American public, if you read the various polls, in particular, you know, I think other always comes out ahead of the two candidates that we have, the major party candidates, at least of the in polls, we have other leading the polls. There seems to be a lack of enthusiasm about this election. Compare this to 2008, where there was tremendous enthusiasm for Barack Obama. Why the difference?
I can tell you that. When you get an opponent who takes this to new low levels, and then you have to take it to new low levels, I've been there, done it. When you get that happening, which happened in my first congressional race, he went at me, I sat, and finally I went at him, and by the time it's done, what ends up happening is you turn people off. That's what you do. You turn them off. And unfortunately for Trump and Clinton, you turn off independents, mm-hmm. is what usually happens. They get very disgusted. You don't turn off your base, you know, you turn off independents. So it's very possible voter turnout will be low. If voter turnout is low, that will give the edge to Donald Trump. But I think what the difference is, you know, even when you had John McCain, you had Barack Obama, neither one, let's face it, got to where these two have gotten. At least, you know, it was a little bit higher level, I think, a little bit more on the issues. This has just come down to crooked Hillary and narcissistic Trump. You know, we all know these phrases they've used on each other.
This upcoming weekend, we'll be remembering the 15th anniversary of the attacks on 9/11. What do you remember about that day?
I was in the U.S. Capitol, and I was in charge of the security of the Capitol, and I was on the phone with the Assistant Sergeant of Arms, and ironically, when the plane hit the first time, I said, oh my goodness, air traffic controllers and the pilots. And then when it hit the second time, I said, it's probably terrorism. And our lawyer, Fred Hay, while I was on the phone with the Deputy Sergeant of Arms, our secretary ran in and said, you've got to talk to Fred, it's an emergency. And Fred was yelling on the phone and said, I'm on the bridge and I'm watching a plane come towards me, it's going to go into the Pentagon. And I told the Deputy Sergeant of Arms that. So we actually knew before the plane hit the Pentagon, and we pulled the evacuation of the Capitol, which was the first time since the British invaded it, it was evacuated. Mm-hmm. And so I was there, and then Steny Hoyer and I, we kind of rounded members up and met over in the police headquarters, because the whole city was an up-down nightmare. Ironically, I was supposed to be in the tower that morning, but due to Ellen Ratner changing her birthday, I wasn't there. I went 7 days earlier.
One of the things that's good for us, by the way, one of the things that plane that crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, that was slated or something.
Capital.
Something. Was headed to the Capitol, and
it was going to hit the Capitol. I can remember the Capitol Police. This, you asked what I remember. I remembered what I just told you, but I remember the Capitol Police saying, run, in 14 minutes a plane will hit this Capitol. And I can remember the police staying there, helping the crowd to go out. And I thought, oh, my goodness, what, you know, brave men and women to do that. And then the other thing I remember so starkly, I got into a cab finally, because the city was just shut down, like, you know, all the cars were abandoned. But I got into a cab the next day, and there was an African-American taxi driver. And the reason I mentioned that, he looked at me and he goes, you know, Congressman, he saw my pin. He said, there's black and white and brown, and there's Republicans and Democrats and straight and gay. And he said, we're all Americans today. I'll never forget that. Hmm. That's what he said to me. He said, we're all Americans today in the same boat.
Very powerful. Yeah. Bob, as always, thank you very much. We'll talk
again.
We'll talk again tomorrow.
That's
Bob Ney from Talk Media News. Up next, your phone calls. We'll talk about the elections. Your heroes, your political heroes, or your political idols. And 9/11. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I want to set up this next segment because a lot of you on Friday were left hanging. And I apologize. We've had a lot of calls coming in over last Friday. And it was on the question, how do you feel about the election? And which political figures do you admire most in your lifetime? And the reason I ask that question is because Peter Hart, who, by the way, I think is a pollster for one of our candidates here for governor in Vermont, Peter Hart did a focus group for the Annenberg Public Policy Center. And what the results were really interesting in that Americans don't really have a lot of optimism about the future. And they used words like political turmoil, unrest, America's going downhill. And when asked to describe the election, the 2016 election, their answers included rotten egg, skunk, stink, garbage. And so that got me thinking, how do you feel about the election? Do you feel the same way or not? And which political figures do you admire most in your lifetime? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Fred in Munkin Ridge. Fred, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you, sir.
I wonder how Donald Trump would be reacting today, sitting in the White House, and to have somebody call his mother a whore. He's very thin-skinned, and I don't think he'd take too kindly to it. Those are the little things that kind of worry me about Donald. He's just too thin-skinned, I think, to be in the White House.
Fred, that's a good observation. What would be Donald Trump's reaction to this sort of insult that the Philippine president made to President Obama this past weekend? He was insulting them. He has since apologized and wants the meeting, and maybe the meeting goes on or maybe the meeting doesn't. But as a world leader, you got to watch what you say. And there are consequences to what you say. And how you react as a world leader is pertinent to how we elect our public officials. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, Mike. I'm going to talk really fast. I want to make 3 points, but I know there's other people waiting to speak. And it's all this bit about Clinton and the foundation and the emails. And I say this, I am not a great fan of the Clintons as politicians, period. So take that to heart. The Washington Post today came out with a story that was more or less, it was exculpatory for Hillary Clinton regarding the foundation stuff. I mean, basically,
is this inside Bill Clinton's nearly $18 million job on honorary chancellor of the?
Right, but that, it's not a matter of does somebody make money off of their name. I mean, after all, what is Don Trump's claim to fame? His claim to fame is his last name, period. So it's not about somebody making money off of their name. It's about whether they abused what they did in order to make money off of that name, and there's no evidence at all that happened. So this is a right-wing freak job, you know, let's build a fire, create smoke, and say, look, where there's smoke, there's fire job. Same thing with the emails. Comey's report, and I've read most of the report that was released to the public, and as it turns out that what Clinton was saying in public was very consistent with what she, as Mary, was consistent with what she said to the FBI the whole time, and that's why Comey came out and the FBI didn't recommend any charges, because Clinton has been honest. And but, you know, these aren't sexy headlines and don't make the news. It's not sexy to say, hey, you know what, Clinton really didn't do anything wrong. She may have been a little bit foolish, but she didn't do anything wrong. Clinton didn't do anything illegal with the foundation. Those don't make sexy headlines. But when you read the stories, that's really what is included in the story. And what is ignored in all of this, people look at various areas of Trump, but let's remember, this is Trump, Don Trump, who, through one of his foundations, made an illegal political contribution to the Florida Attorney General.
That's the $23,000.
Who shortly afterwards dropped out of participating in pursuing a civil case against Trump University. This is Trump, who was personally profiting from his political campaign. He is renting space to his own campaign and his property in New York. He is using his own plane to fly his campaign around, and he's charging. These are not things that are even denied by the Trump campaign. But nobody says anything about these, because for some reason we've got to create all the smoke about Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton to try to create the optics of impropriety. And don't take this personally, but you're partially guilty in this. And it's because of comments like about a week and a half ago, right after I hung up, you said, well, Comey said she lied too. Comey never said Clinton lied to him. Never. Not once. I even went back after you made that comment. I went back and tried to search through for any place where Comey said Clinton lied.
Thanks, Rama, for your call. We'll continue with our discussion about various things dealing with how you feel about the election. I appreciate calls like that. I appreciate passionate calls like that. Sometimes I don't agree with the calls, but I appreciate the passion that's behind them. How do you feel about this election, and which political figure do you admire most in your lifetime? The reason I'm asking that is because Americans seem to be fed up with this election, have no optimism to the future in terms of this electoral cycle or what America is facing. And when asked, they talk about this country in political turmoil or unrest or going downhill. And when talked about the specific election in particular, they say it smells like rotten eggs or skunk or skink or stink or garbage. So wonder what you feel about this election, and which political figures do you admire most in your lifetime? What amazes me is that polling suggests that a good chunk of supporters for Hillary Clinton and Trump are not in support of their particular candidate, but rather loathe their opponent. For example, 30% of Hillary support is because people detest Trump. And 40% of Trump supporters only support him because they can't stand Clinton. And so this leads me to this question. How do you feel about the election, and which political figures do you admire most in your lifetime? The problem with Hillary Clinton is a trust factor. And we can debate whether these events are manufactured or not. But the American public don't trust Hillary Clinton. I mean, if you look at the numbers, just look at the numbers. 74% of respondents believe that Mrs. Clinton would do anything to be president. That includes saying anything or doing anything to be president. 68% say the same of Mr. Trump. Hillary Clinton has a trust factor problem, and that is hurting her in this election. Now, there are partisans in this election, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, that will always try to undermine their particular political opponent. But what Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump are vying for are the independents. And if the independents are feeling that she is untrustworthy, and by the way, Donald Trump being untrustworthy too, then they both have a problem. And maybe it is a race to the bottom in terms of this presidential election. And maybe that's why this focus group found that many people are not optimistic about the future of America or equate the 2016 election as smelling like rotten egg, skunk, skink, stink, and garbage. The other thing I want to turn to as you contemplate that, those two questions, how do you feel about this election and which political figure do you admire most, is coming up this weekend, there will be much focus on the 15th year anniversary of the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks. We will be reminded about the horrors of that day when 19 terrorists commandeered four large commercial passenger jets and then crashed them into the World Trade Center in New York City, the Pentagon just outside Washington, D.C., and into the ground just outside Shanksville, Pennsylvania. What's amazing is almost 3,000 people, I think it was 2,996 people, were killed on that day, and over 6,000 people injured in those attacks. But as tragic as that day was, I remember the heroics of that day, especially our first responders who ran towards the terrorist attacks and not away from them. And some of the things that we talked about with Bob Ney when he was talking about the Capitol police officers who stayed at the Capitol knowing that there was a jetliner headed their way. Of course, that jetliner crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, because of other heroes. Those passengers on that airliner who rushed the cockpit, and probably because they did what they did, saved hundreds or even thousands of lives in Washington, D.C. You know, life changed for all of us on September 11th, 2001. Because we could no longer ignore or be oblivious to events in other parts of the world, nor could we feel completely protected from them. And on that day, we reinforced our vigor and our obligation to protect our citizens. We see it every day, whether we travel on airliners or in airports and bus stations and train stations. We see how this has changed our lives every day. So what we're doing is asking the question, what do you remember about September 11th, 2001? How did it change your life? Or how do you feel about the upcoming elections? And which political figure do you admire most in your lifetime? Let's go back to the phones and Ruth in Sheldon. Ruth, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yes, I think it's terrible that Patrick Leahy won't debate on TV so that the people can see him debating Scott Milne. And I think money buys elections. And if you don't have a lot of money, and Patrick Leahy certainly does, you can't compete against him. And so that's why it's so important for reporters to let other candidates speak. Now, I really enjoy the debates on PBS when they have all the candidates. I think all the candidates who have their petitions in should be acknowledged as legitimate candidates and given a chance the people will sort out who has a chance of winning and who doesn't. But it's nice to see these other points of view. And I really appreciate seeing all the candidates. And I really objected when Marcellus Parson wouldn't let, I think it was Tom Morse, be in the debates many, many years ago. They should let the candidates be in and let the people decide who they want.
Thanks, Ruth. I sort of disagree with you, Ruth, and let me explain why. Vermont faces enormous problems coming up. And having people that don't have a chance to debate only takes time away from the two major candidates who are going, one of which are going to be governor of this state. I do agree with you that debates are important, though, because you pointed out they're an attempt to level the playing field between a well-heeled incumbent and an outgunned opponent. And also debates matter because we get a rare opportunity to hear and see from an incumbent, especially a U.S. senator, for example, as you mentioned, a U.S. senator who's been in the Senate for 42 years. We have never as a state, thrown out an elected U.S. senator. Now, remember, this is only since 1913 because prior to that, the legislature voted or decided who would represent our state in the U.S. Senate. But we've never thrown a U.S. elected U.S. senator out. So to me, debates matter because we get that rare opportunity to see and hear a U.S. senator without the protective staff and the information cocoon that often surrounds them. And let's face it, they do not, U.S. senators at least, do not get the same scrutiny that, say, a governor gets. They are protected by their staff. They are protected by distance. So if we have debates and more debates, we get to hear real answers to real questions and then those answers being challenged. To me, it seems that's how a democracy should work. And the greater number of debates that we have, the better it is for Vermonters. So thanks, Ruth, for your call. Agree with you on one point, disagree with you on another point. Let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Well, Mike, I'm going to have to go with Ruth on that one. And I believe she is right. There's a point of view that needs to be expressed. And everybody might have, you know, you never know what good idea will come out of one of these candidates who don't have the money to get their positions on television. And who in God's green earth gave the Democrats and the Republicans the pick-all? Apparently they can't pick out that well to begin with. And the reason I was calling you was, you know, everybody's complaining about Clinton and Trump. You got two other candidates in the race that are capable. Those two people will not be on the stage unless they get 15%, you know, survey. And half the people don't even know who they are. I think if they did get on that stage, you might have a different outcome to the national election. I know you probably wouldn't have in our gubernatorial, but you know what? Maybe Spaceman's got one good idea that needs to be implemented that might change something in the state. And why not have that out there? I mean, you've heard everything Sue Minner and Phil Scott have got to say if you've been paying attention.
Sam, thank you for your phone call. We're going to disagree on that. I just, you know, look. Here's the bottom line. The Phil Scott campaign is requiring for them to show up to debates that Bill Spaceman Lee, who's the former Red Sox pitcher, great guy, by the way, had a great sort of pitching career with the Red Sox and other places, be allowed to participate in any debate that between Republican Scott and Democrat Sue Minter. As I said before, having Bill Lee on the stage would boost any media outlet's ratings. It would be entertaining. It would garner lots of attention, maybe even national attention. What it will not do, however, is give Vermonters a clear-eyed view of how Phil Scott or Sue Minter will lead Vermont forward. And let me explain why. A debate between Bill Lee on stage ensures that one-third of the debate time is diverted to a candidate that will only garner about 10% of the vote. This means one-third less time to focus on answers of Sue Minter and Phil Scott. And this is when Vermont is facing a serious challenge. And in these times, Vermonters demand concrete proposals, a clear vision, a bold leadership. They aren't looking for entertainment. And so I think it's important. And Ruth talked about the PBS debate. I could not glean one important point from those PBS, those Vermont PBS debates. They were a show, I'll grant you that. But I couldn't glean where we were going as a state from those debates. And that's why I think these debates are extremely important. Where are we going as a state? We've got major problems, and it's time to address those problems. And Sam, I thank you for your phone call. We disagree on this issue. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We got about 6 minutes ago. If you want to give us a phone call, please do in a hurry here, 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. What we discussed today, and I'll move on for tomorrow, but what do you think about this election? Americans are not very optimistic, according to a focus group, about this election. Who do you admire as a political figure? Who is a political figure that you admire? And lastly, we've been talking about debates, whether Senator Leahy should debate, whether Bill Spaceman Lee should be included in debates. But also through the next couple of days, I'm going to bring up 9/11 because it changed us. It changed us in so many ways. And I know some of you want me to talk about Benghazi, and I'll do that as well, because we did have a terrorist attack on September 11th, 2012. But the equivalence may be a little bit different, although the ramifications, I would argue, are quite severe in terms of what happened in Benghazi. But 15-year anniversary this year, September 11th, 2001, terrorist attacks. How did it change your life? How did it change America? Give us a call. Well, you know what? Tom, because we've got short time, I'm going to just take one more phone call. Rob from North Carolina, you're on. But you only got about a minute, Rob.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Yeah, 911, changed our lives. We became part of the vulnerable set of countries, nations that understand that security and freedom is going to require some courage and some sacrifice, Mike. And we just have to face that, and that is something that's going to be with us now for who knows how long. And with the rise of ISIS and its expansion and its popularity, really, to like-minded people, it's a real scary thought for us. And we know that they're in within our borders, Mike. I think there's no, you can't refute that at this point. And so we have to be all the more vigilant, Mike.
Rob, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it. I want to thank our guests today, which included Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College, and also Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst, talking about the upcoming election here in Vermont. They did a great job, and I wish to thank them for doing that. And also, Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos. We talked about, are Vermont elections secure from hackers? And Jim Condos assured us that Vermont has taken precautions against hackers here with our elections. And, of course, I want to thank all of you, because without you, this show would be less than it is. Your calls, your passion, and sometimes I don't agree with your position, but that's okay. That's what this program is all about, is your opinions. Coming up this week, we're gonna revisit some of the things that 9/11 taught us and some of the impacts that 9/11 had on us. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls today. Have a great rest of your day. And guess what? We'll talk again tomorrow.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.